is going to be this coming Tuesday, June 16th at 6 p.m. And where we've been holding all of our meetings so far is actually in Lentz Park, in the gazebo that's in the middle of the park.
Okay, great. Well, I wish we had more time. Thank you, Kathleen Juergens-DePonce and Nick Christensen and Friends of Lentz Park. And we're going to wrap it up here. I'm Dave Mazza. This is Voices from the Edge. We'll see you next week. Same time, same station.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that glitter is gold?
The Family, an underground, shadowy organization of fundamentalists influencing U.S. and world governments for decades. Its leader, Oregonian Doug Coe, spiritual counselor to former dictator Suharto of Indonesia, and at times to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, get an inside look at this vast and secret group determined to spread Christ to the world's leadership. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund. Join me and my guest, Jeff Charlotte, contributing editor for Harper's and the Rolling Stone. He went inside the Family's training camp, Ivanwald. Tune in as we discuss his book, The Family. That's this Thursday at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
Good morning. You are listening to the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, June 11th. Coming up, Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. What would single-payer health care really look like? And did the Japanese government just try to smuggle $134 billion in U.S. bonds to beat the collapse? That's coming up right now on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
It's 9:02 a.m. in the beautiful Pacific, 1602 hours GMT, and you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Press Watch, insights and incitement, the news you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. How much did you make this week, if you're working? Did you get $265 unemployment benefits? $300? Did you work all week and make $400? Well, you're obviously not a CEO if that's the case. If you were a CEO, you'd make a little bit more than that. U.S. CEOs in the Fortune 500 earn 344 times the average worker pay. Now let's set that average worker pay at $12, say. Let's set it really, really low and say that's the average worker pay, because, you know, a lot of workers are paid pretty low down. And say you worked all week and you're the CEO of a corporation that pays the average of $12 an hour. That would be low. You'd be a low CEO of a Fortune 500. Well, you would only take home $165,000 per week. Honey, I worked all week and I only made $165,000. The reason I put it that way is because if you look in the mainstream media and the corporate-owned media, you'll find that there are some worries, some complaints. People are a lobbyist, actually, or coming to Congress and saying, if you put these pay caps on our CEOs, we have a problem motivating people. $165,000, I mean, that's just a week. $17 million a year. You think people can get by on that? Let's suppose we had a maximum income tax, of 94%. That happened after World War II, actually. And let's say that 94% was set at $1 billion, 1,000 million annual income. There are people who get that much. I won't say earn. No one earns that much. But, you know, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, they easily earn a million or so or several million a year. Say they, excuse me, billion. I got to get used to that. 1,000 million, billion with a B. Let's say that poor old Bill Gates only made $1 billion this year, and we taxed him at 94%. Such an unfair rate. I mean, my gosh, that would leave him with only $60 million a year, enough to fuel that yacht, you know, with the two attached submarines and helipad, or is that Buffett? I forget which. Maybe they both got him like that. Australia right now is considering capping CEO pay at 10 times the minimum worker pay. Ooh, that would hurt. Then if you only paid your workers $12,000 a year, you can only make $120,000. Oh, gosh. What would you do? Maybe you'd have to pay your minimum workers more. You can't have that. You know, you often hear from the right-wingers, and you listen to the right-wing radio, which is all over the place. Really, there are only a couple of exceptions, aren't there? Listen to the right-wingers, and they will tell you this is the greatest nation on earth. The richest. But you know, if you really look at the stats, something different appears. Here are the U.S. rankings. Several of the U.S. rankings out of the 30 OECD countries. That's the Economic Cooperation and Development, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. People who actually track these things say that of those 30 countries, which would be the 30 richest countries, by the way, 30 countries, and yet... where do you think the U.S. would sit in infant deaths? Well, we'd be 28th out of 30, followed by Mexico and Turkey. And where would the U.S. be in life expectancy? Life expectancy. We'd be 24th out of 30. Only in Mexico, Turkey, Hungary, Poland, and the Czechoslovak republics do you have a worse life expectancy. And why is that? Well, maybe it's because our health expenditures are number one. Out of 30. Hey, we're number one in something. We're number one. We're number one. Keep chanting that because I have some more statistics. What is our poverty rate of the 30 OECD countries? You know, in this great, great country, this amazing, this leader of the free world, well, we're 28th out of 30. Mexico and Turkey are worse. Mexico and Turkey have worse poverty rates. 27 other countries are better. Child poverty, 27 out of 30. That leaves Mexico, Turkey, and Poland. Hey, we're better than Poland. Income inequality, you still think we're you think we're the best, do you? Income inequality, 27th out of 30. That leaves Mexico, Turkey, and Portugal. Obesity, 30 out of 30. How'd that happen? Incarceration, 30 out of 30. We're the worst. Hey, we're number one. Work hours ranked in ascending order. That is, how many hours do you work compared to, 30 of the OECD nations? Well, we're the worst. You work the most. Frankly, you're serfs because you're Americans. Hi, Americans. Serfs. Ranking in oblivious suckers, sneering at the rest of the world even though they know nothing about it. Number one. Oh, that's my statistic that came from the... TFL essay, the Teresa's Frontal Lobe Statistics Analysis Agency. Do you know someone who died of a too late diagnosis because they are forced to ignore their health problem until it threw them into the ER and they were diagnosed then as they died? Do you know someone who's going around with tooth pain because she can't afford a dentist? I think maybe you do know someone like that. Have you put off your own health care because you know the deductible is too high for your budget? Or because you suspect it will not be covered, maybe as a pre-existing condition, by your fly-by-night for-profit insurance. I mean, Great American Insurance Company. Well, then rest easy, because you know that you're protecting the billions in profits and salaries of the most expensive healthcare system in the world. But have you wondered what healthcare is like in Canada? That terrible socialistic program there in Canada? The answer is in the Denver Post. Rhonda Hackett of Castle Rock, Colorado, a clinical psychologist, wrote... some of the following, in part. She's a Canadian citizen. I present it here peppered with my own comments, of course. She writes, myth number one, taxes in Canada are extremely high, mostly because of national health care. In actuality, she writes, taxes are nearly equal on both sides of the border. Overall, Canada's taxes are slightly higher than those in the U.S. However, Canadians are afforded many benefits for their tax dollars, even beyond health care. For example, tax credits, family allowance, much cheaper, higher education. So the end result is a wash. At the end of the day, the average after-tax income of Canadian workers is equal to about 82% of their gross pay. In the U.S., the average is 81.9%. A wash, right? Departing from what she wrote. But you're a serf denied college and medicine, and they're not. Myth. Canada's health care system is a cumbersome bureaucracy. She writes, the U.S. has the most bureaucratic health care system in the world. More than 31% of every dollar spent on health care in the U.S. goes to paperwork, overhead, CEO salaries. Did I say CEO salaries? Yes, CEO salaries, profits, etc. The provincial single-payer system in Canada operates with just a 1% overhead. Think about it. It is not necessary to spend a huge amount of money to decide who gets care and who doesn't when everybody is covered. Myth. The Canadian system is significantly more expensive than that of the U.S. 10% of Canada's GDP is spent on health care. For 100% of the population, the U.S. spends 17% of its gross domestic product, but 15% of its population has no coverage whatsoever. And millions of others have inadequate coverage, you know, sort of like yours. In essence, the U.S. system is considerably more expensive than Canada's. Part of the reason for that is uninsured and underinsured people in the U.S. still get sick and eventually seek care. People who cannot afford care wait until advanced stages of an illness to see a doctor and then do so through emergency rooms, which cost considerably more than primary care services. What the American taxpayer may not realize is that such care costs about $45 billion per year and that someone has to pay it. This is why insurance premiums increase every year for insured patients, while copays and deductibles also rise rapidly. Now, if you ingrates would just die, we wouldn't have that problem. Ingrates, uncovered ingrates. Myth. Canada's government decides who gets health care and when they get it. Actually, while HMOs and other private medical insurers in the U.S. do indeed make such decisions, heard of that? The only people in Canada who do so are physicians. In Canada, the government has absolutely no say, that would be no say, nothing, in who gets care or how they get it. Medical decisions are left entirely up to the doctors, as they should be. Here in the U.S., medical decisions are left up to denial clerks. So it's departing from the text. It's kind of taken apart the old Rush Limbaugh argument about socialized medicine, isn't it? Maybe you need socialized medicine, like socialized. Oh, that's so scary. Oh, my gosh. Someone might heal me. Returning to the article, there are no requirements for pre-authorization whatsoever in Canada. If your family doctor says you need an MRI, you get one. In the U.S., if an insurance administrator says you are not getting an MRI, you don't get one, no matter what your doctor thinks, unless, of course, you have the money to cover the cost. Myth. There are long waits for care, which compromise access to care. There are no waits for urgent or primary care in Canada. Now, let me read that again. There are no waits for urgent or primary care in Canada. Departing from the text, ever been to the ER at the wrong time of day? Ever been to the ER at the right time of day and waited and waited and waited? Ever heard of people dying while they're waiting? Why, yes, me too. Returning to the text, there are reasonable waits for most specialist care in Canada and much longer waits for elective surgery. Yes, there are those instances where a patient can wait up to a month for radiation therapy or breast cancer or prostate cancer, for example. However, the wait has nothing to do with money per se, but everything to do with the lack of radiation therapists in Canada. Despite such waits, however, it is noteworthy that Canada boasts lower incident and mortality rates than the U.S. for all cancers combined. According to the U.S. Cancer Statistics Working Group and the Canadian Cancer Society, moreover, fewer Canadians than Americans, that would be 11.3% versus 14.4%, admit unmet health care needs. Myth. Canadians are paying out of pocket to come to the U.S. for medical care. Most patients who come from Canada to the U.S. for health care are those whose costs are covered by the Canadian government. So if a Canadian goes outside of the country to get services that are deemed medically necessary, not experimental, and are not available at home for whatever reason, for example, the shortage or absence of high-tech medical equipment, a longer wait for service than is medically prudent, or lack of physician's expertise, the provincial government, where you live, fully funds your care. Those patients who do come to the U.S. for care and pay out of pocket are those who perceive their care to be more urgent than it likely is. Myth. Canada is a socialized healthcare system in which the government runs hospitals and where doctors work for the government. Actually, Princeton University health economist Uwe Reinhardt says single-payer systems are not socialized medicine, but social insurance systems, because doctors work in the private sector while their pay comes from a public source. Now, departing from the text, that's terribly disappointing for me because I like frightening people with the phrase socialized medicine, comrade. Returning to the text, most physicians in Canada are self-employed. They are not employees of the government, nor are they accountable to the government. Doctors are accountable to their patients only. More than 90% of physicians in Canada are paid on a fee-for-service basis. Claims are submitted to a single provincial health care plan for reimbursement, whereas in the U.S., claims are submitted to a multitude of insurance providers. Heard of that? Moreover, Canadian hospitals are controlled by private boards and/or regional health authorities rather than being part of or run by the government. Myth. There aren't enough doctors in Canada. From a purely statistical standpoint, there are enough physicians in Canada to meet the healthcare needs of its people, but most doctors practice in large urban areas, leaving rural areas with bona fide shortages. More on that in a minute, by the way. This situation is no different than that being experienced in the U.S. Simply training and employing more doctors is not likely to have a significant impact on this specific problem. Whatever issues there are with having an adequate number of doctors in any one geographical area, they have nothing to do with the single-payer system. And these are just some of the myths about the Canadian healthcare system. While emulating the Canadian system will likely not fix the U.S. healthcare, she writes, it probably isn't the big bad socialist boogeyman it has been made out to be. And I would disagree with her there. I'd say it would fix it just fine, and we should do it. But she writes, it is not a perfect system, but it has its merits. For people like my 55-year-old Aunt Betty, who has been waiting for 14 months for knee replacement surgery due to a long history of arthritis, it is the superior system. Her 35,000-plus surgery is finally scheduled for next month. She has been in pain, and her quality of life has been compromised. However, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Aunt Betty, who lives on a fixed income and could never afford private health insurance, much less the cost of the surgery and requisite follow-up care, will soon sport a new high-tech knee. Waiting 14 months for the procedure is easy when the alternative is living in pain for the rest of your life. Or, departing from the text, I should say, waiting 14 months for the procedure is easy when the alternative would be being a U.S. citizen. And that would be too bad, wouldn't it? And we all know an Aunt Betty, don't we? Speaking of healthcare, do we have enough beds with our wonderful capitalist system? Capitalist healthcare system for profit. Do we have enough beds and ventilators for a pandemic? I've mentioned before on this show that we most certainly do not. Because they're not profitable. It's not profitable to have beds sitting around in case there's a pandemic. It is prudent to do so. It is medically necessary to do so. It's a societal must, but we don't do it because it's not profitable. I ask the question because, well, we don't have them, and fortunately for Canadian residents, there are less present sufficient resources to deal with the swine flu pandemic. Did I say swine flu? Didn't that go away and prove that the liberal media was yada, yada, yada? Actually, the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority has been forced to send away for 15 additional ventilators. That would be ventilators that are used, you know, for intensive care for people who are really in trouble and need help breathing. 15 additional ventilators and to postpone scheduled surgeries because the hospital there is crowded with swine flu patients. This from Reuters by Stephanie Nebehe. The World Health Organization was poised today, 1600 GMT or a few minutes ago, to declare that the new H1N1 virus has caused the first influenza pandemic in more than 40 years. The move will trigger heightened health measures in the WHO's 193 member states as authorities brace for the worldwide spread of the virus that has so far caused mainly mild illness. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Margaret Chan was to hold a news conference on the outbreak at 1600 just now. Flu experts advising Chan, who met earlier today, were expected to recommend moving to the top phase 6 on the WHO's 6-point scale. That would reflect the fact that the disease, widely known as swine flu, was spreading geographically but would not necessarily indicate how virulent it is. Phase 6 She said, if we call a phase six, doesn't mean anything concerning severity. It is concerning geographic spread. Pandemic means global, but doesn't have any connotation of severity or mildness. That's, well, actually, Gregory Hartle said that. In fact, he said, what we are seeing with this virus so far is overwhelmingly to date mild disease. So we would think that this event is really a moderate event for the time being because the numbers are high, but the disease is overwhelmingly mild. And that was what he told Reuters Television just before the talks today. But will it stay mild? The 1918 flu did not. And consider this from CBC News. Canada Broadcasting said more than 200 people from St. Teresa Point First Nation have fallen ill since the start of last week. The majority of the ill are being treated in the community located about 500 kilometers from Winnipeg. It's about 320 miles, I guess. Those with the most severe symptoms are now in Winnipeg, including two who are in critical condition and two others who have been confirmed to have swine flu. One of them is a woman who was pregnant but has since miscarried. Altogether, 27 people from the reserve have been flown to Winnipeg for treatment. Two cases of swine flu have also been confirmed at Garden Hill First Nation. Chief David Harper said schools and daycares are closed, public events have been canceled, and the band, the tribe is what we would say in the U.S., is sanitizing buses and police vehicles at least twice a day. And in Split Lake Cree First Nation, about 120 kilometers north of Winnipeg, the community's clinics are packed and so many children are sick with flu that the school has to be closed. And the schools are also closed in South Indian Lake, 900 kilometers north of Winnipeg, due to suspected swine flu cases. Harper and the other chiefs are calling on the federal government in Canada to boost healthcare services and improve housing on reserves. In 1918, influenza had the overcrowded barracks of World War I soldiers to spread in, and it did so quite efficiently after the first wave, which was mild. Now that situation with the barracks is gone, and it's been replaced with 2.3 million people in prison, for example, and a broken healthcare system that could not possibly even begin to deal with a real pandemic. We're number one. Keep repeating that. We're number one. We're number one. How does that stack up on the possibility of another bioweapons attack, for example? There may be another, since we haven't solved the first crime in 2001. This from AnthraxWar.com website, which advertises a new movie about the biowar attack, which I hope to review myself later. They write, on August 1st, 2008, the FBI announced that it had found the culprit in the anthrax attacks. U.S. Army scientist Ruth Ivins, who had worked at the very heart of the U.S. military biodefense forces, but authorities announced that he had just killed himself with an overdose of prescription Tylenol before criminal charges could be brought against him. Richard Spritzel, the former deputy commander of Fort Detrick, the germ war lab where Ivins worked, summed it up pretty nicely in their film, quote, "Nice and convenient, isn't it?" end quote. Because with Ivins dead, the FBI's case would never have to be proven in a court of law. In fact, Spritzel and many other experts that the film crew spoke with said that it was impossible for Ivins to have manufactured the very sophisticated weaponized anthrax used in the attacks. I'm going to depart from the text here and mention that the anthrax was something that was experimented with at Fort Detrick, but that was in a developmental and analytical sense. It was weaponized anthrax. The weaponization had to have happened elsewhere. And so what they say is true. That scientist could not have produced the static-bound weaponized anthrax, which was only available. Actually, it was from the Ames strain, not the Volham strain. If you may remember, if you followed this for years, did come from the U.S., but didn't come from Fort Detrick. To weaponize anthrax, they write, the spores have to be milled and refined into microscopic single spores, which are tiny enough to be breathed into the lungs, making it a deadly killer. The anthrax powder used in the 2001 anthrax attacks is considered by many experts to be the most sophisticated and refined ever seen. Detrick does not have the equipment to weaponize anthrax, nor did Ivins have the skill set to produce this kind of sophisticated powder. So, is there an anthrax conspiracy? Oh, there's that word. It would seem that high-ranking members of the government believe that there is. At a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing in September 2008, Senator Patrick Leahy, one of the targets of the anthrax-laced letters sent to Congress, blasted FBI Director Robert Mueller, saying he believed there were others besides Ivins who could be charged with murder, end quote. So I would say that issue just isn't settled. And about the FBI, well, I could say a lot, but I won't right now. If you're a longtime Press Watch listener, Then you may recall that the Clinton administration got annoyed enough with the North Korean regime to consider and prepare extensively for war in 1993. I think it was 93, or around then. The Obama administration is in a similar position now. And so I've started following movement of military supplies. Easiest to follow is the Navy. The six ships of the Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group crossed the international dateline June 9th, entering the U.S. 7th Fleet Area of Responsibility. Yesterday, the strike group is made up of the flagship, the Nimitz-class aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan, the embarked carrier Air Wing 14, the guided missile cruiser USS Chancellorsville, and the ships of Destroyer Squadron 7. That would be include guided missile destroyers USS Decatur, Gridley, Howard, and the guided missile frigate USS Thatch, T-H-A-C-H. I mentioned these because you might want to follow that those ships and find out information as to whether there is any mobilization against North Korea. I would say it's kind of a danger. This information was from defpro.com. They write, "We are ready for any mission, any tasking," said Captain Kenneth Norton, Ronald Reagan's commanding officer. USS Ronald Reagan's commanding officer. "Our sailors are prepared to carry out any mission in this region." Of course, they always say stuff like that and doesn't mean a thing, but it is worth following that. I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks, and I encourage you to follow what's happening using News Search, which is what I do for this program. We're talking about 60 ships together with the other 7th Fleet units, the USS George Washington stationed in Japan, etc. Any strike on North Korea would involve these ships to some degree. So, what does North Korea say about what's going on? Here's what they write, part of what they write on their KCNA news website. The U.S. is openly hinting, they say, at the nuclear war scenario. Trumpeting about the provision of an effective nuclear umbrella to protect its allies from the non-existent military threat from the DPRK. DPRK means North Korea, in case you don't already know. Lurking behind the U.S. promise, they write, to provide a nuclear umbrella to its allies is a criminal scenario to forward deploy more nuclear weapons in South Korea, Japan, and the other areas around the Korean Peninsula, and spark off a nuclear war there on a legitimate basis under the pretext of a military threat from North Korea. The U.S. description of North Korea's nuclear test as a threat to its security and other allies is nothing but a sheer sophism intended to misinterpret justice as injustice and vice versa. That's the way they write on the DPRK's website, which is KCNA, if you want to look it up. They also write, "It's an open secret that the U.S. has hastened the preparations for a nuclear war against the DPRK, North Korea, on the basis of a secret agreement made with South Korea and Japan long ago. They are now contemplating carrying out the nuclear war on a legitimate basis under the pretext of the latter's military threat. The U.S. dispatched a nuclear-powered carrier flotilla to the Pacific while conducting a malignant smear campaign over North Korea's nuclear tests, and now it is vociferous about the provision of a nuclear umbrella to the said countries under the signboard of protecting its allies." So, something to watch. Finally, Italy's financial police, the Guardia Italiana di Finanze, have seized U.S. bonds worth $134.5 billion. Yeah, I said billion with a B. $134.5 billion. What's wrong with that figure? From two Japanese nationals at Chiasso, 40 kilometers from Milan, on the border between Italy and Switzerland. They include 249 federal U.S. reserve bonds worth $500 million each, plus 10 Kennedy bonds and other U.S. government securities worth $1 billion each. You can get that at asianews.it in English, and it's the only site in English right now that has information on it. Damn peculiar, for a number of reasons. They write, "Italian authorities have not determined whether they are real or fake, but if they are real, the attempt to take them into Switzerland would be the largest financial smuggling operation in history. If fake, the matter would be even more mind-boggling," they write, "because the quality of the counterfeit work is such that the fake bonds are indistinguishable from the real ones." Now, I would say there's other reasons why that would be bizarre. This is quite the issue in Italian newspapers. Igiorno.it, you can find it that way. I have a separate question, though. Is the Japanese government trying to jump the gun on a dollar collapse by secretly unloading hundreds of billions? In Switzerland, while they can still get a good rate? It seems that once the financial markets twig to this sort of thing, the dollar could experience a panic. But so far, there's been little reaction, which is interesting because, as the article points out, These bond amounts are only issued to governments, so it's unlikely that these are mere counterfeiters because they would not have a market for their goods. The size, half a billion each bond, is just too big. Conversely, it is far more likely that they are representing a government and that that government is likely to be Japan. Why would they sneak the bonds in? Well, if they exchange the bonds for, say, euros openly, then the sheer amount of the transaction would degrade the value of the remaining Japanese and the world's dollar assets. Something to think about. I'm going away for 2 weeks on vacation. And I thank you for listening to the news you're not supposed to know. And stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
The City Repair Project's annual Village Building Convergence takes place across Portland June 5th through 14th. The theme for this 9th annual VBC is Momentum, Powered by the People, chosen to reflect the collaborative energy and creative forces that citizens can build together. VBC includes over 25 neighborhood sites who have been organizing community-based projects such as water catchment systems, intersection paintings, and cob benches, which will be built during the week. The VBC also includes live music, workshops, meals, and speakers, including activist Starhawk, Robert Laporte, natural house building pioneer, and permaculture designer Larry Santoyo. The full schedule is available on the City Repair Project's website at cityrepair.org/VBC.
Good morning. It's a Thursday morning radio zine. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Linda Olson Osterlund hosts a new show, A Deeper Look, with a focus on the family. This is an underground, shadowy organization of fundamentalists influencing U.S. and world governments for decades. So very interesting. I'm very curious about that. She's going to be interviewing Jeff Charlotte. We're going to be reaching him by phone in a minute. And then at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentaries with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, the power of boycotts, sanctions, and divestments against the Israeli apartheid regime, and more on single-payer health care from yesterday's hearings in Washington. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg interviews Eugene writer Miriam Gershaw about The Local News, a novel about a missing boy and how his disappearance affects his sister, family, and friends. And 11:30, Words and Pictures with S.W. Konser and possibly a Pender brother, at least one. Coming up all this morning on your listener-sponsored community radio, KBOO Portland. And now stay tuned for Linda Olson's Osterlund's new show, A Deeper Look.
Good morning, and thank you for joining me for the debut of A Deeper Look Inside Key Challenges Facing the World Today. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, and today we're going to get a look inside a secret and very influential fundamentalist organization, one that brings together in prayer groups dictators, diplomats, congressmen, and CEOs. Our guest is Jeff Charlotte. He's the contributing editor to Harper's and Rolling Stone. He joins us today by phone from a hotel in Boston about him. We're talking about his book, The Family, the Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. I'm really pleased to have him as a guest. He's made quite a stir with his most recent article also in Harper's Magazine. It was the cover article of the May issue, and the title was Jesus Killed Mohammed, The Christian Crusade to Convert the U.S. Military by Jeff Charlotte. He has been investigating and going inside the fundamentalist movement and a part of the movement that most of us have not heard of before. This is a part of the movement that has been kept secret from us, though it's had influence on the politics and policies and social organization of our society since before World War II. And when he joins us, we'll be able to get his inside look at this organization. I know that for many of us, the whole question of evangelism, the right, the Christian right, has been on our minds quite a bit in the most recent period. There was the murder of Dr. Tiller recently. That man has ties to right-wing religious organizations, the man accused of killing him. There was also a killing yesterday of at the Jewish Museum. That man is apparently an independent lone right-winger and only visited sites on the web. But in both of these cases, we're seeing a rise in murders from the right. And I'm wondering, what role do organizations like the Family play in that? Not so much as being a conspiracy, but in terms of ideologically supporting that kind of issue, that kind of action. And we know we've seen it with the talk show hosts, but the organization we're going to be looking into isn't really the same one. They may be linked, they may have cross relationships, but the organization we're looking into actually focuses on Christianity for leaders. It's total focus is going into leaders. And I'm going on a little bit here because our guest is not yet here on the phone. We've had a little problem with our connections this morning, but I'm sure he's going to be joining us soon. I'll give you a little bit more background about the family. We won't necessarily be able to go into all of this with him. They began in Seattle, believe it or not, and the current leader is a man named Doug Coe, who is an Oregonian. Hard to find, but he is an Oregonian, and he is the spiritual leader of this organization. But back in the 1930s, when a general strike shut down Seattle, that's when this organization first formed. There was a man named Abram, and he believed that, one, the strikes and all of that were demonic, were Satan, taking away property from the chosen. And he had this idea that the most important, that God had chosen the successful. God had chosen the ones who were the wealthiest. And so he actually brought them together there in Seattle for their first prayer group to take back private property for the rulers. So right now we've got Jeff on the line, and I want to welcome him. Jeff, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad that we were able to connect with you. It looked like we might not be able to a little earlier, but that might have been...
Apologies. I got here just in time, but I'm glad to be here. I'm a big fan of... I've known about KBOO for years. I'm a fan of the station.
Well, and I was pointing out that the current spiritual leader of the family is Doug Coe, and he was an Oregonian, and part of your book took place here when you visited Portland.
It does, yeah. I went out there. The family began back in 1935 up in Seattle, but quickly sort of spread through the Northwest, and then the man who is leading it today came out of Oregon, and so I ended up going out to Oregon to research the roots. I knew that that had kind of moved on, and ended up writing in the book toward the end about just a little group of evangelical Christians who meet in house churches who are not a part of the family. But I sort of wanted to say, look, what we see here is the sort of the cultural spread of ideas that began seven decades ago in the Northwest and have really transformed American Christianity and towards a more authoritarian vision of the religion.
Yes. You know, you were introduced to the family when you were invited to live at Ivanwald, sort of their training facility for young men in Arlington, Virginia. Can we start talking about that a little bit? Share your experience at Ivanwald. It was quite illuminating to me, including that you were sort of, I thought it was like a gang beating you in. They crushed you in, so to speak.
They called it the fumble. Yeah, this was several years ago. I was working on my first book, Killing the Buddha, which was about sort of religious life and eccentricities around the United States. And a brother of a friend invited me to come check out this place called Ivanwald. And he didn't describe it as being having any organizational affiliation, but... when I got there, it's a house at the end of a cul-de-sac in Arlington, Virginia. And it's part of a community of about 20 properties that are owned there in Arlington, the chief of which is this beautiful grand mansion overlooking the Potomac called the Cedars, where the family hosts diplomatic meetings and business meetings and that sort of thing. And Ivanwald is a house for younger men who are sort of being groomed for future leadership. When I first wrote about this for Harper's, they called it Undercover Among America's Secret Theocrats. And the funny thing was, it wasn't undercover. I sort of told them who I was. I didn't know then that I was going to be writing about them. And they're so complacent in their influence and in their power, I don't think they assumed that I would ever see anything negative. But within days, I saw this very strange culture, and you allude to what they called the fumble, which was basically 13 men jumping on top of me and giving me a whopping as their way of introducing me into the family and into this idea of what they think of as biblical manhood, which I think a lot of people would just recognize as classic machismo.
Well, yes, it does sound sort of, it's the same old muscly men bonding kind of activity. It might be a football game or a tag football or something like that, where they all pile on each other. I found it amusing, and yet these men are devoted to what you call elite fundamentalism and the chosen. Can you talk, and also this thing called, this movement called Jesus Plus Nothing, can you talk about elite fundamentalism and how is that different from, say, the mass movements of the Christian right?
Yeah. That's really the main argument of my book, The Family, and what I hope is its contribution to the sort of discussion about the religious right and politics and so on that really not a lot of other writers have had a chance to look at yet. I had access to the 600 boxes of documents of the family's existence going back 70 years, and I mean, it's an incredible collection of personal letters, but also government material, confidential material, international correspondence. The family very quickly grew into this very internationalist organization. And unlike non-religious folks tend to think, when they say fundamentalist Christians, they think of a kind of a caricature that they may be seen in a movie as a sort of a southern rural Bible thumper. That's not the family. The family is it's very upper crust, upper class. The men I was living with were all from elite families, and they were from around the world. They were from the Czech Republic. They were from Japan. They were from Paraguay. They were from all these sorts of countries, and they're sent there to make connections. The family, really, what they decided was, years and years and years ago, the guy who founded it in Seattle said, look, he had been organizing Goodwill Industries. He had been a pretty effective organizer. And he says, you know, here I am helping the poor, but it's not really doing anything. I help the poor one by one. What if I could get top men, key men, and they could restructure society according to God's will? He called it totalitarianism for Christ. He was very comfortable with that idea. He was comfortable with the idea of fascism. And they will then help the poor people. So we'll take this chosen. God chooses his elites. If you're wealthy, if you're powerful, it's because God wants you to be, and therefore we want to be friends with you. And what this has amounted to is, in the words of one Christian critic of the organization, a religion of status quo power. The family is conservative, and they're in Cold War, fiercely anti-communist and so on, but the bottom line for them has always been power, and that's why Doug Coe, the leader today, likes when he's giving seminars to congressmen and senators and ambassadors and so on. He says, look, three men in the 20th century understood the New Testament better than anybody else. Can you guess who it is? And, you know, people typically say, I don't know, Martin Luther King, or, you know, they have the usual suspects and good choices. Doug Coe says, no, it's Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. He says they're not Christians, but what they understood is the New Testament is about power, and that's their vision of Christianity and the idea of elite fundamentalism. It's very different than the kind of populist fundamentalism that we see among the televangelists.
They really believe that if you are in a position of leadership, it's because God has chosen you to be there, and what they want to do is, and that's whether or not you know it. Of course, your religion could be something completely different. You could be a religious, you could be Jewish, you could be Muslim. But if you're in power, they believe God has chosen you for some reason to be in that power. And they reach out to you with prayer groups. I found this so interesting. They formed, they kind of copied after World War II, and we could, I would love to go into more depth about their collaboration with the Nazis. And then post-World War, they're actually getting Nazis out of jail because they were Christians and putting them in the new German government. But beyond that, they formed themselves. They took the communist organization of cells, and they formed themselves into small groups of prayer cells. And then those prayer cells reach out to contacts around the world and invite them to pray with them. And they literally will get on their hands and knees with dictators and probably good people too, leaders of industry, congressmen, Supreme Court members, presidents, vice presidents, and pray together. And I thought, you know, this totally makes sense to me from their perspective, in that when you are in an intimate situation with people, and they actually call it cognitive dissonance when you're talking about psychology, you can't keep saying something and not begin to believe it. Our brains are designed that way. So I think they've brilliantly organized themselves. They're vast, though. Can you talk about some of the names of people? Can you tell us names of people we would recognize that you encountered while you were at Ivanwald?
Sure. Senator John Ensign of Nevada, Ed Meese, the Reagan's former attorney general, a lot of people don't recognize, has become one of the key conservative power brokers in Washington, a guy who's sort of a bridge builder between business conservatives and social conservatives, and the man who really steered through the Sam Alito and John Roberts nominations. None of whom, I should say, are members of the family, although the late Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist was very active with them over the years.
And Sandra Day O'Connor would go fishing and hunting with Coe.
She did, although, I mean, she was not
that shocked
a member
me.
Of it. And, you know, that's one of the interesting things about them and makes them different than other religious right groups is they've never been captive to the Republican Party. They tend to lean very strongly Republican, but they're interested in power. They've endured 70 years not by making themselves an electoral bloc, and they'll sort of say that we rise above politics. And, you know, for instance, Senator Mark Hatfield from out in your corner of the country was a very, very involved member. You know, he was a Republican. No one's going to call him a far-right winger.
But he was independent enough to oppose the war when the rest of them saw that as a war that God was helping spread, well, stop communism and spread Christianity through the U.S.'s power.
He did, and I think the interesting thing about the family is, and some listeners are probably saying, well, gee, that's not so bad, you know, this guy opposes the war. The family aren't warmongers. They're globalists. They believe in, they want the world to be safe for business, and not because, there's nothing cynical about that. They think that God works through the market. They're very clear on that. So an example, Senator Sam Brownback.
I'm sorry to laugh, but they really do believe that God invented free enterprise and that it's their duty to carry it forward throughout the world.
Exactly. An example Senator Sam Brownback gave me, and this tells you how the prayer cells work. He talked about, and I got to spend a lot of time with him, he talked about collaborating with Representative Joe Pitts of Pennsylvania, both Republicans as it happens, both very conservative Republicans, on something called the Silk Road Act. Most listeners probably aren't familiar with this certain kind of Taliban and so on spread into the Central Asian republics. We're going to be hearing more about this. What this was legislation designed to do, as he explained to me, was one, to combat Islamic extremism in the Central Asian republics, and he was going to do this by beefing up their dictatorships, and we've seen how well that works. And two, he said, to open up those countries to as free trade as possible and to help American companies. And I said, well, what does that have to do with your religious motives? He says, well, the gospel follows trade.
Religions, I mean, they're not off the mark in the sense that the religions of ruling entities and occupiers do tend to take over the countries that they're occupying. I'm speaking with Jeff Charlotte. He is the author of Jesus Killed Mohammed, the cover article of the May Harpers, and of the book The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin here for KBOO. Jeff, I wondered if you could talk about, however, that they don't have what I found most interesting. And I've jokingly said to my friends, well, you know, what kind of freedoms does the right wing want us to have? The freedom to shop? And after reading your book, I'm scared that I found that their religion in some real way, though intense and intensely believed, empty. There was no moral core to it that I could see, that they had no problem with Suharto, who they prayed with, massacring between 800
billions of dollars of military aid towards
them. Absolutely, and through multiple presidents, including Carter, sending aid that helped in the massacre of those people, and yet they regularly kneeled down and prayed with him. And I could only think, well, what were they praying for? And but apparently when you ask them questions about that, there's no problem with killing innocents. There's no problem with any of that, because if you are the chosen ones, you are carrying out God's will. And so that's just the way it is. And I personally find that horrifying, especially in light of Dr. Tiller's death and the man killed at the Jewish Museum, when there is no right or wrong as we used to recognize in forms of Christianity, like, you know, don't kill, for example.
Well, that's what they mean by Jesus plus nothing, and they're very explicit about this. I sat in, actually, in a meeting with Doug Coe and Congressman Todd Tehart, also Kansas, from Wichita, Kansas. And Tehart was not a member of the family. He wanted in. He was, sort of a congressman on the make, and he knew that he needed to be connected to this if he was going to have access to certain networks. And so Tehart was a very traditional conservative, out there in Wichita, Kansas, which was a very conservative place where Dr. Tiller was just killed. And he was saying, well, you know, we have to stop abortion because Christians are losing the population race with the Muslim, and they're having too many babies, and we're killing ours. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, this is fine, but it's not what it's about. He says, look, that's all fine, but what we're doing here is bigger than that, it's broader than that, and it's Jesus plus nothing, not Jesus plus this set of politics, not Jesus plus morality. He says, that's not for us. We don't believe in morality. We just obey God. It doesn't matter. We let God decide what he's going to do. So you mentioned Suharto. A great example of that, very well documented in their archives, is back in the 60s when Suharto took over Indonesia. Although Suharto was a Muslim, the family decided that he was the man God had chosen to lead Indonesia, and they started sending delegations mixed of congressmen and oil executives over to meet with Suharto, who, of course, controlled one of the...
What a perfect combination.
there's a great letter from an executive of Phillips Oil coming back saying, I've just had an hour with Suharto, and it was the most spiritual hour of my life. And, then a big deal follows that, and it's also one of the most lucrative hours of his life. That, I should say, mention of that meeting was in a memo sent around to members of the Senate who were part of the family, and then the family arranged for Suharto to come and have private meetings with members of the Senate and also members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they felt that what Suharto was doing was exercising power according to their New Testament ideal. So it didn't matter that he was a Muslim. Or the worst story, I think, in the book is that of Siad Barre, the late dictator of Somalia, who brought Somalia to the sorry state it's in today. Senator Chuck Grassley, still in the Senate today, in the 80s, became part of a prayer cell with Bill Brehm, who's a major defense contractor, and Suharto, who described himself as a Quranic Marxist, not likely recruiting for this group, but the Soviets had dumped him as a patron. He needed a new patron, and one of the clearest letters that I ever found in their archives, he's writing to the family and to some of their staff members who were then also in the Reagan administration, saying, okay, I'll pray to Jesus, and here is what I want. I want my arms budget doubled. I want a meeting from my defense minister with Ronald Reagan, and I'm going to need to crack down on some dissidents who are giving me trouble, and I want the United States not to have a hands-off policy about this. Well, Doug Coe writes back, in effect, done, done, and done. And then we go back and we look at the historical record, And so it was.
And that shows the influence of Doug Coe and the way that they're organized, these cells, and the fact that they are with the most influential people means they can arrange these kind of meetings with leaders and top industry so that they actually can have a very clear influence on directing our future. And I think you were a little bit more relaxed in your book than I would be, Jeff. I do think that there have been some pretty serious changes that have been wrought in our society. And when I look back and I see, like, for example, I remember Gerald Ford being asked about the massacres by Suharto, and his what he said, and I saw the tape of him saying this, was, well, all I remember is that my dear friend needed help, and I was happy to give it. And so they're in this position, and their idea of help and their idea of morality is pushing, quote, free trade forward. And they have...
Oh, it's not even an idea of morality. They're actively and openly opposed to morality.
Well,
and
which
they also actively reject democracy. They think democracy is a sin. If democracy means that we people think that we know how to run our affairs better than God,
and that's taking it out of God's hand and usurping God, and that's satanic. And this movement has come together and sort of joined together with the more populist movement of fundamentalism. And you do go into that in your book. And I wish that we could spend more time on it, but we're actually running through time. And I want to get to a couple other things. I want to ask you about the military and their influence in the military. And I also want to ask you about, I'll mention her name now, Monica Goodling and the Department of Justice under Bush's, their hiring scandal. She came out of the Christian colleges. What was the family somewhere behind this kind of thing as well with Alberto Gonzalez?
What I'm always trying to get, especially progressives, to think about is to think about the religious right not in the terms of some kind of monolithic organization.
Yeah, and that's why
certainly
I'm asking, did they have a relationship?
No, I know, and I'm glad you're asking. I think it's a great question. You know, there's no conspiracy, there's no organization. It's a social movement, and I think we have to come to terms with that. We tend to think of social movements as good things. This is a social movement for reactionary forces. So Monica Goodling, no, she's not a part of the family. They were part of that. Monica Goodling, listeners may remember, came out of Pat Robertson's Regent University.
Right.
Pat Robertson has always had a lot of links with the family. His father, Senator Absalom Willis Robertson, a Dixiecrat senator from Virginia, was a board member of the family. And Pat sort of went in a more populist direction, but through Regent University, through his Christian Broadcasting Network, they kept these connections. And so we see... we see basically people who share a broad set of ideas helping one another. Goodling was famous for bringing, I think, 150 graduates of Pat Robertson's Fundamentalist Regent Law School.
Well, and that's one of the dangers that I think we face right now is that these changes aren't gone because the administration has changed. Most of those people that she got hired who met the right-wing Christian, they're still in power, right?
They're lifers. I mean, I think this is one of the
things. Yeah, they're lifers, and the same in the military, and the same with these congressmen.
Well, the military, I just wrote this story you mentioned called Jesus Killed Muhammad about fundamentals in the military, and I started about a year ago, and then I was sort of wondering, well, let's see what happens with Obama and see if this changes. And there was talks amongst Obama's people about pursuing a pretty hard line against the sort of real... genuine subversion of constitutional principles by top-ranking officers. This is not a fringe thing. We're talking about General Bob Caslon of
Petraeus, even General Petraeus,
division commands in the army. We're talking. This is generals. This is an officers thing. And Obama decided to take a hands-off approach to that in the same way that he's done to faith-based initiatives, which was a project actually the family conceived of, very well documented in their archive back in the 1980s, and they saw it. Not as, hey, churches are doing good work. They saw it primarily as a privatization engine. They actually used that word. This is a way of privatizing federal dollars and putting them into religious hands. And at the same time, you're striking a blow, in their mind, for the faith, and you're striking a blow for capitalism, which they see as one and the same. All these things are continuing under Obama. Obama's taken a hands-off approach to faith-based initiatives. He has completely abandoned the promises he made in the campaign. The Bush era rules that allow religious organizations to discriminate using federal tax dollars remain in place. And he said, hey, look, we're not going to touch them. I've appointed a committee to look at them. The committee is three-quarters religious conservative. So he's using this, I think obviously he's got a lot of other problems to address, but...
But he isn't addressing some of the ones that would concern us with regard to this, and that, from my point of view, they feel like they're going to just grow. They're pretty good at growing themselves.
The family's been around for 70 years. You know, they're not going to go away because you have a Democrat, even a Democrat who
wasn't Hillary Clinton even in their Senate prayer circle when she was in the Senate? Wasn't she in the regular Senate prayer meetings they've set up? Not one, maybe a member.
I dedicate a chapter in the book to looking at Senator Sam Brownback and Senator Hillary Clinton as a pair, as illustrative of the way that influence works. Brownback's whole career is through the family. I mean, from when he was a college kid interning for Bob Dole and living in a family house.